Welcome to another edition of Pitt Bulletin Legal News Radio, part of the Pitt Bulletin Legal News Network. Broadcasting each Tuesday night at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time, the show covers the latest pit bull news across the country, including breed-specific legislation, the real story behind recently reported dog attacks, fact-checking on dogsbite.org, litigation updates, and a live call-in discussion. Call 646-595-4137 or join us in chat during the show.
Welcome to Pitbull Legal News Radio, March 10th, 2015. I'm your host, Fred Cray, and here with my co-host, Chris Brown Sugar Diaz from Stop BSL, along with the rest of the Pitbull Legal News crew, including Denise, who's in the chat room. Tonight, we're going to be talking about shelter liability for post-adoption dog bites. It's an interesting topic, I think, for shelters. I cannot give legal advice to specific state shelter people, so this will be sort of a general discussion of the law and cases that have been passed in the last, I guess we have a case from 1945, the first one, but mostly they've been decided in the last 10 or 15 years. And try to give shelters and rescues some idea of how they can minimize their potential liability in general. So before we do that, let's try and put Chris on the hot seat.
Previously on Pitt Bulletin Legal News Radio.
So Chris.
So Fred.
Are you there?
I'm there. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Oh, good.
So it's good. So what did we talk about last week?
Last week, we talked about non-adoption policies for pit bulls in shelters and the relation that that has to the prohibitions on breed discriminatory laws that these states have been passing.
And that's a good topic. And what was your takeaway from that?
I had no idea a shelter policy could be tackled using these particular laws. You know, I had been under the assumption, as many other people, that because they are a private policy, that the laws didn't affect it. And I find it absolutely interesting and encouraging that there is actually case law regarding this, and that there is a way that this issue could be tackled legally.
Well, I must confess I didn't get to blog about it this week, but I will try over the weekend this week to do it. There's been a lot of stuff going on here behind the scenes, and so just been doing some other things. But Denise is in the chat room. Let's find out how her marriage plans are going. Denise, how are your marriage plans?
They are still a go. So far, so good.
All right. Well, we'll keep up with that during the show. You might have a change. We don't know, but if there is, you have to break in and tell us breaking news.
Okay, I'll be with like the beep, 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 beep.
Yeah,
beep,
that's
beep.
Right, that's right. So I guess the weather down there was hot today, huh?
It's disgusting, actually. It's not even cute. It's warm.
So was it over 80?
Yeah, it was.
I thought.
Hit like 85.
All right, well, Chris, what is it where you are?
Today was probably around 50, like 55, between 55 and 60. And
well, that's balmy for you.
It was incredibly humid and rainy all day. And, you know, I'm so excited about it warming up. And, you know, I can't wait till summer.
Are you sunbathing to get ready for the summer? Were you out there in your bikini
today?
Not yet.
I'm perpetually pale, so... okay. Yeah.
Does that mean you're a vampire?
No, I just burn really easily. So I avoid, if I'm going to be out in the sun, I put on a lot of sunblock, and I do not sunbathe because I always burn and, you know, be sunburned. It's terrible.
Yeah. Being red can be embarrassing.
It's not easy being red.
That's right. So, all right, so if you want to check in with us on chat, you can go to if you're listening live, you can go to the Blog Talk Radio URL where you're listening to the show live and click the chat button and sign in with your Facebook credentials and chat away. Denise will check in with you later in the show. Let us know if there's anything exciting going on over there.
Sounds good.
All right. All right, so let's do a little bit of news here. I guess the first thing I have to ask is, after we're done with the news, do you have any BSL news this week, Chris?
Yep, we have a couple of items this week.
All right, well, I'm not going to hog them because I probably know what they are already because, you know, following this news and everything. I guess the biggest thing this week that I noticed was Hulk is everywhere. He's everywhere you look. There's Hulk being ridden, being, you know, whatever. He's going to go for the Guinness Book of World Records for the biggest pit bull, even though he's really not a pit bull. I have two minds about it.
And here's a real shocker that's stemming from all of this publicity. The fees, the amount of money that they were getting for the dogs has raised.
The fees for what?
For buying one of his dogs. I think they were saying it was like $20,000 or something for, you know, a quote unquote protection trained offspring of the Hulk. And now apparently that amount is
$30,000. Wow. That's some dough, man. You could buy a car for that. It's the Hulk or the car. What do you pick?
I would pick the car considering that these dogs are, you know, from what I can tell, they are not checked out for any genetic diseases and do not have any OFA or PENHIP ratings and, you know, all of the things that really, really diligent, responsible breeders test their dogs for. These dogs do not appear to be tested for any of that.
Well, wow. And somebody hasn't photoshopped this dog green, you know, and made him the Hulk for the superhero.
You know what? I don't know, because that would be such an obvious thing to do. Maybe that's why nobody's done it.
All right. Well, there's two things about this. One is, you know, he looks really great and he's smiling and he's, you know, all that. On the other hand, he's not a pit bull. So, you know, it's kind of a mixed reaction to the Hulk for me. How about you?
Yeah, he looks like a very lovely dog. I'm sure he's very sweet. I'm sure, you know, he's a great dog. I have a lot of problems with him in general, and not just because of the pit bull thing. I have a problem with the images of the child riding the dog.
Yeah, that's not a good thing.
That have been all over the place. I have a problem with the glorification of what is essentially a backyard breeder. I have a problem with the fact that the dog registries, the paper registries, the kennel, you know, the clubs that he's registered with, have not really taken a hardline stand on the fact that the dog is a mixed breed dog. It's right in his pedigree. You can find, you know, the mixes in his pedigree, dogs that are not registered as American Pit Bull Terriers. And, you know, he's not by any stretch of the imagination, but I find it incredibly unfortunate that, you know, this dog has this much publicity. People are buying these dogs for a ridiculous amount of money. And then, you know, they're going to turn around and they're going to breed them. Like, it's a little ridiculous to assume that these people aren't going to be breeding his offspring, considering how much publicity there's been and how expensive they are.
Well, this leads to a good segue into something that came out from the American, American Dog Breeders Association or something?
Yes, the ADBA.
Yeah. They came out today. And what was the significance of that to you?
Well, the American Dog Breeders Association, for anybody who hasn't seen it, has put out a statement saying that they are now going to be going through their registries. We had GP Juarez from the American Preservation Dog Registry on earlier, and he talked a little bit with us about the dog Wannabe a Whopper, and we spoke about paper hanging. They are looking into not only that specific dog's registration and papers and lineage, but they are going to be basically working their way up in time. So they have stated that they're effectively going to be doing an audit of their registry, which is fabulous. I'm very glad they're going to be doing that. And I hope that they actually act on some of this and this isn't just a token thing. Because the Hulk thing has garnered so much attention and the owners claim that he was registered with the ADBA as an American Pit Bull Terrier. And the ADBA said that, you know, we got a lot of inquiries, but we're not that they said he isn't registered with them. But I heard sort of on the sly that this was a little bit of a political thing, that that no, he is not in fact currently registered with him. However, he has paperwork in to be registered with them.
Right.
So, you know, the best thing I think that they can do is deny that.
Yeah. Well, it does expose the underbelly of the breeding of these gargantuan dogs, the triple X dogs or whatever they're called. So that's the Hulk. That's that thing has been publicized everywhere. The other story that came out today that was, to me, is a perfect example of why breed discriminatory laws don't work. In Oakland County, Michigan, the city of Hazel Park, a woman's pit bull saved her from domestic violence, and when she reported to the police said, well, that's great, but you have a pit bull and we've banned them. You've got 5 days to get rid of your dog. What a terrible way to learn that, you know, you can't say what kind of dog you have. So I looked at the statute for Hazel Park, which is in Oakland County, and the interesting thing about this statute is that it's pretty much unconstitutional, believe it or not. What they've done is what they did in Hazel Park is they've defined dangerous dogs as including a pit bull, and then they named three breeds. And then what happens is that they go into the statute and they say, okay, if your dog is a pit bull, the animal control officer can investigate and give you written notice that your animal is a subject of the violation, and that you have to remove the animal within 5 days. But there's no hearing, no due process, nothing that allows the person who owns the pit bull to say, wait a minute, before you tell me to get my dog out of the city for 5 days, prove he's a pit bull. Prove that, you know, he has the characteristics. And then they turn around, and in the next section of the statute, they say, but if your dog is a dangerous animal that has caused severe injury or to a person or dog, now you do get a whole panoply of hearings, you know, and you get to go to court, have a hearing, you know, and all this other stuff. So it leads to the same crazy result that we had in Ulana, which is a dog who has bitten somebody gets more due process than a dog who's done nothing, in fact, saves his owner from domestic violence, and gets no hearing. So, you know, again, we have a situation where you've got somebody telling someone that they have to get rid of their dog before they even have the, and they, according to the statute, they never have to come forward and prove it. They can just say it, give you a notice of violation, and then you have to get your dog out. So it's completely, I suppose their defense to this would be that, you know, once you get a violation, once you get a notice of violation, after you don't remove your dog after 5 days, you get a due process hearing after that. But the problem with that is they've already, the state has already taken state action by telling you have to get your dog out. How can you tell someone to get their dog out before you have just established that the dog is, in fact, the breed of dog that's prohibited? So it's a really terrible situation there, and I hope some lawyer would take that and protect that dog by challenging the statute as not giving due process. So we'll see how that all turns out. I think most people can't afford it, and they just basically take their dog out of town and move, basically, which is really letting the city win because that's what they're trying to do in the first place. What was your thought on this story, Chris?
Well, I agree with everything that you say, obviously. And maybe I shouldn't say obviously because we do disagree about some things. But, you know, it's absolutely, I think, highlights one of the primary flaws in these laws is the fact that there are people who are, you know, good people who have good dogs who just, you know, they don't know what's going on. And I know they say ignorance of the law is not a defense. You know, I do understand that. But when you deal with something like a breed discriminatory law where it's like, this is not a common thing. It really isn't.
Well, I don't blame a person for not knowing whether their dog has the appearance of being predominantly of one of these three breeds. I mean, so if I adopted a dog from a rescue and they said, hey, it's a pit mix, and I went to a town, I wouldn't know until the cops told me that it was 51% pit bull. I mean, how would you know that? I'm looking at the dog that they, in Reynoldsburg, that they defined as a pit bull. I look at the picture and he looks like a Labrador Retriever to me. How somebody could say the dog is a pit bull, 51% pit bull, is crazy.
And especially since we know that the identifications are so subjective and all the studies that they've done of shelter workers and animal control officers and everything, people don't agree with each other on these things.
Yep. So, and also there's a Cardell case that says animal control officers don't meet the Fry-Dalbert test. So that's another issue about the identification. Continuing on with the news, what did the mayor in Springfield, Missouri say? Because I saw an article that said city mayor ridicules pit bull enthusiasts. He said that the mayor, Robert Stevens, postponed the vote on the pit bull ordinance because the guy he wants is going to vote for the ban is not going to be at that meeting. And I saw, did you ever hear what he said?
I was under the impression that it was actually the opposite, that one of the council members had wanted the potential repeal to be postponed because one of the people who was going to be voting for the repeal was on vacation.
No, but the question is, what did the mayor say?
Unfortunately, I didn't see the mayor's comments that, you know, people are upset about.
I saw a comment to his comment is all I saw.
I did not see that. I had only seen, you know, some very kind of cut and dry articles about the situation saying, you know, effectively that the vote's been postponed and that, you know, they want to try to get it in after the person gets back from vacation, but within the next month because a couple of the council members are leaving, their term's running out. But I did not see any outrageous comments by the mayor.
All right. Well, did you read the story about we had a fatality this week? Pit bull kills a man who was trying to revive his owner in Wheeling, West Virginia.
Yeah.
Did you read about that?
Yes.
And of course, in that case, the dog was allegedly a pit bull and he wasn't registered under the city's pit bull regulations, which I think you talked about that last week when you said that this. This shows that pit bull regulation doesn't work because this dog wasn't registered. And apparently, I mean, the only thing I can think of is that, you know, when you're reviving an owner and you're trying to give him CPR or whatever, the dog could think that you're trying to hurt his person.
Yes. And officials have actually been pretty understanding, considering that they do have a breed discriminatory law in Wheeling. And, you know, there is this history of you know, having this pit bull registration restrictions in place. But officials themselves have said that the likely scenario is that the guy had a heart attack and his, you know, the person came and was trying to revive him and the dog thought that he was trying to hurt him and was being defensive. Of course, we are seeing, and I want to clarify this for, you know, some people, because we are seeing, of course, the dogsbite.org crew saying that the dog, that there is a report floating around out there that the dog attacked both of these people and killed both of them. As of the information that has been provided to this minute, and I've looked at a lot of these reports trying to find where they are getting this information from, the dog's owner does not have bites on him. You know, he is being basically ruled that the cause of death is a heart attack. And, you know, it's the other gentleman who was attacked by the dog and they believe also suffered a heart attack. They were in both gentlemen were in their 60s. Mm. So they believe that both ultimately, you know, had a heart attack, the one as a result of the dog attack and the other one from a medical, you know, medical history. He had a poor health in general. But, you know, we have, of course, seen them spin this out. And, you know, it's very interesting because they do have a breed discriminatory law. And, you know, when we say that breed discriminatory laws don't reduce dog bites, then we hear, oh, well, they're not made to reduce dog bites. They're made to reduce fatalities.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not the only case that we have of a fatality happening in a place with a breed discriminatory law. And, you know, some of these other fatalities are dogs were caused by dogs that are not targeted breeds.
Okay, one more story before we get to your brown sugar. Apparently there was a dog park shooting that killed the dog. I didn't write down the city that it happened in. But apparently this guy was at a dog park. A pit bull was playing with his dog. He whipped out his gun, shot him to death. The dog's name was Diesel. He claimed the dog was hurting his dog, but apparently witnesses have said that the guy overreacted, that they were just playing, and he just pulled his gun out and shot the dog, and there was no necessity. As a result, they have charged this guy with one count of animal cruelty, and I guess he's going to, you know, I guess he faces 2 to 10 years in jail. So that's a... And I guess he had the right to carry the gun. He had a concealed carry permit. But bringing a gun to the dog park is never a good idea, I don't think.
I wouldn't think so either.
Well, it's not only just for the dogs. I mean, there's a lot of arguments at the dog park over dogs. Well, your dog did this, you know. And I've seen fights. I've seen, you know, all kinds of things. I would hate to see a gun get involved in some of the hot tempers that go on there. So, in any case, let's cut to... All right, Chris, did you just cough during your intro?
I did. I'm sorry.
You thought that the Rolling Stones would cover
myself,
it up.
But...
You were trying to hope the Rolling Stones would cover it up, but you were wrong.
And I pulled my mic away from my mouth because I didn't want to cough in everybody's ear, but, you know.
All right.
You just do the best you can.
That's right. So let's talk about Pawtucket. That's the first thing I want to talk about. It's the most outrageous. Go ahead.
Yes. So a bill has been introduced in Rhode Island, effectively by the Pawtucket representatives, you know, the people who are who specifically represent Pawtucket in the state legislature. Yes. Well, they, you know, we spoke very recently about the case that they lost against, they were sued by the Defenders of Animals and Albert Alex regarding their breed ban, saying that
was on.
Yeah. They said that they had the right to retain their breed ban, and, you know, the Defenders of Animals and Mr. Alex said that they do not because of the recently passed state law that prohibits breed discriminatory laws.
Right.
Pawtucket lost that case.
Didn't appeal.
They had the right to appeal, yep, but they did not appeal. Instead, what they did is they turned around to introduce H5800, which would amend the state's recently passed prohibition on breed discriminatory laws by including the language basically that says that a city that had a breed discriminatory law before July 15th of 2013 would be allowed to keep their law until such time as it is repealed by the city council or local governing body. So it's been assigned to the House Municipal Government Committee. And as of right now, there is no date been set for a hearing. People are being urged to contact the state legislature, the committee specifically, and then also their specific representatives, you know, that represent their district, to ask them to oppose the bill. Pawtucket will not give it up.
Nope. They won't,
and it's
kind of like the Selesky case, you know, same thing, only in reverse.
Yeah, this is not the first bill that we've seen for, you know, trying to allow a town to get their breed discriminatory law back in Rhode Island. Last year, we had Warwick, who had introduced a bill saying that that specific town, would be allowed to reenact their breed-based mandatory spay-neuter law, which that did not move forward past committee. So, you know, I they don't give up. You know, I got to give them points for determination. But at the same time, you know,
they should have appealed
if
they thought that strongly about it.
Yeah. They had the
right
to
appeal. Let's not do that. Let's
appeal. Yeah. And, you know, the fact that they're trying to do this legislatively just goes to show the fact that they knew that they would lose an appeal. And so, you know, we're sort of waiting and seeing what's going to happen with the committee, if the committee is going to schedule this for a hearing or not, or if they're just going to refuse to move on it. So I'm assuming the bill sponsors aren't going to be pulling this. So, you know, we'll, I guess, just have to wait and see. But if you are in Rhode Island or if you know somebody who lives in Rhode Island, the contact information for the committee is on stopesl.org. You can go in there and, you know, look at the room. Just search for Rhode Island and it'll come right up and you can get all that information. You can see the text of the bill and the bill itself. And, you know, we'll keep everybody informed as this continues.
All right. Next, I want to talk about Wausau, because Cindy Ryder is stepping back, your old friend. The lady whose chihuahua was killed, she's stepping back and letting someone else take over for her.
Yeah. It's not a shocking move, considering that she does have a very negative history in the town. She's not exactly the most beloved person in that particular municipality. You know, history of very erratic behavior, including threatening a 12-year-old. So, you know, still the word from the council is basically, yeah, they can bring this up if they want. But we're, you know, they seem to be pretty well-versed on the issue.
Well, you know, I read some of the statistics in an article, and it said that they had 7 pit bull bites out of 53 bites. That doesn't sound like to me like a justification for a ban. I mean, you've got 7
and
out of 53.
Of course it's not unless you have a vendetta. And, you know, and as we know, many of these people have a personal vendetta. It's very personal to them. And, you know, it's horrible what happened to her dog. You know, it really is, and it should not have happened. On the flip side of that, you cannot legislate for the minority of, you know, of instances like that. And it does seem like the council understands that this is not, you know, this is not an issue. It is not even an issue in their town. You know, some places, like you could say, oh, yes, pit bull types do bite, you know, more often. Of course, you find out that those are the more popular dogs in the area.
Right. Nobody really knows, you know, can really say, because they don't know how many pit bulls there are. And when you add when you add mixes into it, you can be adding, you know, 3 different breeds into 1 breed. So,
at least,
if you're Reynoldsburg, you add in Cane Corsos or Connie Corsos and the American Bulldog to those statistics for pit bulls. So,
yeah. And that's sort of, you know, we see that big stack of different breeds coming in with the per VSL groups in general, bull mastiffs, American Bulldogs, you know, and any dog that even might consider looking
maybe
like.
You go to the smell test, you know, if it smells like a pit bull, you know, they could have an olfactory test where, you know, you smell and you go, this would be good. This could be, you know, this could be more scientific than visual identification.
I wouldn't know what a pit bull smells like, but.
I wouldn't either, but I mean, I'm just saying. It'd be just as, just be just as valid.
Yes. So we have a couple of other little things. We have a news story coming out of Indiana where a veteran with a post-traumatic stress disorder support animal, who happens to be a pit bull, they talk about how he's having difficulty finding places to live because of breed discriminatory laws in the area. One town official in particular, and this is from Oxford, Indiana, has stated that the council is waiting to hear. Basically, they want to hear from family. They want to hear them out. So, you know, there might be some activity there. We'll just kind of have to see what happens with the family when they relocate. So kind of keeping an eye out there on Oxford, Indiana. And one last little item is Wilmington, Delaware, is discussing the potential to repeal their breed discriminatory restrictions again. This was brought up about a year ago. There was a potential ordinance in play that had passed the first, you know, had passed the first committee and was moving forward. And just sort of, you know, it ended up just kind of fizzling. But there is another push now to bring a new proposal to repeal their law forward. And, you know, hopefully they'll have something officially drafted soon. But right now they're looking for residents to come forward and show support for a repeal. So, you know, again, all this information is on StopESL. So if people are in those areas or know somebody who is, let them know what's happening in their community and help try to encourage them to get involved.
That's so great. You're so inclusive.
Yes.
All right. Let's take a little station identification and we'll be back with discussion of, I feel like it's kind of like homework, but shelter liability for post-adoption bites.
Pit Bulletin Legal News Radio wants to hear from you. Email your news stories or tips to us at pitbulletinlegalnewsradio@gmail.com. Don't forget to tune in on Tuesdays at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time to catch the latest news about breed-specific legislation, dog bites, and litigation at www.blogtalkradio.com/pit-bulletin-legal-news. Join the discussion and chat or call us at 646-595-4137. Pit Bulletin Legal News Radio is brought to you by the Pit Bulletin Legal News Network, the first and only network of pit bull-related information for owners, advocates, lawmakers, and the media. Visit our network of experts at www.pblnn.com for all things pit bull. Find news, upcoming and archived shows, statistics and studies, as well as ownership and advocacy information, all in one location. That's www.pblnn.com, the Pit Bulletin Legal News Network.
All right, we're back, and I'm going to discuss shelter liability for post-adoption dog bites. And it's an interesting topic because when I've discussed last week's topic, which is pit bull adoption policies, with the policy makers and stakeholders in the shelter industry or in the city shelter or the government entities, the one thing they always say to me is, we don't want to adopt out pit bulls because we're afraid of being sued for liability if the dog bites somebody. And so what I'm going to talk about now is just in general these issues of liability because I think it's important for everyone who deals with pit bulls to understand, you know, what is the liability of a shelter for pit bulls that it adopts out and how you can minimize the prospect of you having a problem with pit bulls if they adopt them out and something happens. So what I would say is the case law starts out in 1942, where a lady named Elaine Menches sues the Inglewood Humane Society because after she got the dog, somebody owned it, and then they got bitten by that dog that was adopted out. And basically what happened was the person who got bit sued not only the person who owned the dog, but the Humane Society that had adopted the dog out to that person. And the court in that case held that Humane Society could not be held liable under the dog bite statute because the dog bite statute required you to be an owner, harborer, somebody who had control over the dog at the time that the incident occurred. And they said, look, the title to this dog vested in the injured woman and her husband who had adopted the dog when they paid the impounding fee and acceptance of the animal. So the first thing that you have to think about when you're looking at this issue is making sure that you don't retain an ownership interest in the animal. I know a lot of shelters and particularly small rescues put a clause in their contract that says, you know what, if in forever now until the dog dies, if we feel the dog isn't being taken care of or we want to come and inspect it, well, if you do that, you run the risk of keeping ownership interest in that dog and having a situation where if someone gets bitten subsequently by that dog, they'll say, well, we're going to sue the owner of the dog, but we're also going to sue you as the rescue because you've retained some right of control over that dog and therefore an ownership interest. And I've talked to rescues about this, and they seem very they don't want to do that. They don't want to pass on entire title and give up title to the dog. But I'm here to tell you that if I ran a shelter and I was adopting out any dogs, I would not retain an interest in the dog. I would not retain any rights that I could that would allow me to be sued in a subsequent incident. And this case started in 1942, and that theme continues on through the case law that's discussed after that. The next case, there are only about, I'd say, 10 cases that discuss this issue. So it's not like you have to read a lot of cases. The next case was decided by the Wyoming Supreme Court called Larson versus the City of Cheyenne. And in that case, somebody adopted a dog, and the dog got involved in a subsequent incident, and the injured person sued the City of Cheyenne, and the court in that case said, look, the dog was adopted by the dog warden's brother, who was made fully aware of the vicious habits of the dog, and the city and pound owners were not owners, keepers, or harborers. The city did not owe a duty to plaintiffs, and thus could not be held liable for the bite. And so, again, we get this issue of not being an owner, keeper, or harborer by contract. But we also have, now we're adding in that proper disclosure has been made about the dog's previous history. So, you know, if you have a dog, you must disclose his previous problems. If he was vicious or if he had a previous bite, you need to just disclose that in order to not be held liable for fraud, for not properly, you know, advising people about the prior history of the dog. So the two things that we've learned so far is, one, you can't be an owner, you can't retain an ownership right, and you've got to properly disclose the past history of the dog. The next case happened in 1987. It was Champaign versus the Spokane Humane Society. Now, this is another issue that comes up, and that is if when you adopt the dog out, you make a separate special promise. So in this case, what happened was the rescue made a promise to the people that were adopting the dog that they would patrol the area and apprehend any stray dogs, and whether it met the society met its duty of care. For failing to apprehend pit bulls that were running loose. So in this case, obviously the issue was a little different than a private rescue because a private rescue doesn't have any duty to apprehend loose dogs. So in this case, that special promise that made it a question of fact whether they were liable was this special relationship exception, and that comes up in a lot of different in some subsequent cases. And basically what that means is if you adopt a dog out and you say, okay, we're going to require you as a part of this adoption to take to have a trainer, to have a certain way that you keep the dog enclosed, you've got to keep those promises. The best thing to do is not make such promises and to put something in your contract that says, that you're not making any representations about whether the dog will bite. You're disclosing whatever it is that the dog previous history is, and you're not retaining an ownership interest. And it's one way to really keep your liability from a subsequent incident. So this same incident, this same issue came up in Richardson versus the Humane Society, the Michigan Humane Society, in 1997. And in that case, a person adopted the dog and had it. There was a sign on the dog's cage that said the dog was good with kids. And after the dog was adopted, obviously a six-year-old minor got bitten. So the person who, the family of the person of the child, sued the Michigan Humane Society, saying, "Look, you said in this on this dog's cage that it was good with kids, and then we took it home and it bit my kid." And in this case, the court said, and I'll quote, "There was no showing was made that the statement contained in the sign on the dog's cage at the society that the dog was good with kids was false when made." So in other words, the Humane Society didn't know that was an improper representation. The pet adoption agreement expressly excluded any warranty of the dog's temperament, and Humane Society's animal evaluator testified that the society's policy was not to guarantee that a dog will not bite, and he had seen no sign of dangerous propensities in the dog. So what we take away from this case, in addition to not being an owner and making sure that you make truthful representations about the dog's previous incidents, is that you do your proper due diligence in terms of having a temperament tested, and you make sure you put in your adoption agreement that you're not making a warranty of the dog's temperament when the person adopts the dog. That's what we come away. That's the lesson of Richardson versus the Humane Society in Michigan. There's also a case in 1997 from the Supreme Court of South Dakota called Tipton versus the Town of Tabor. And in this case, a parent and a child who was mauled by a caged, privately owned wolf-dog hybrid sued the city and county for allowing this adoption to take place. And in this case, the court said that granted the town's motion for summary judgment, finding that this county had no actual knowledge of the dangerous propensities of the hybrids. The parents and child did not reasonably rely on city and the county in adopting the dog. Child was not a member of particular class to be protected by an applicable statute, and the city did not aggravate the risk of harm by licensing hybrids or inspecting pens. So what this case really talks about is not really germane to private shelters, because in this case the town has animal control sort of duties to obviously to make sure that there are statutes about hybrids and so forth is an inspection. They have those duties, and what the Supreme Court of South Dakota is saying, look, they have those duties, but that doesn't mean that they guarantee that all these hybrids that are adopted out by private shelters, they don't guarantee that they're, because just because they do the inspections, they don't guarantee their temperament. So the Supreme Court basically held that the town of Tabor was not liable to the parents of this of the child or the child for their injuries.
Can I interrupt for just 1 second, because I just want to make sure that I'm clear on that last particular case. So this was not the city had no involvement in the placement
it was
dog.
Basically they had a duty to inspect, you know, just under animal control laws, and a duty to to make sure that they met the inspection standards. And basically what the court was saying, look, unless, you know, there's a specific duty to this specific person, you can't just make somebody liable for enforcing animal control statutes. They just said basically that, you know, that because the because they had the statutory duty to do these inspections for, you know, shelters, that didn't make them. I'll read to you what it says. It again goes back to the special duty rule, the special promise kind of thing I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
They were trying to say that there was that this met the special duty rule. In other words, that the city had made some kind of implicit promise, and they said county had no actual knowledge of dangerous propensities of caged, privately owned wolf dog hybrids, and mauled child, despite law enforcers' knowledge of structure of wolf dog pen, and fact that veterinarians' rabies receipt referred to animals as wolf. No complaint was ever made about any danger hybrids posed. Hybrids had never bitten or snapped at anyone as far as the city and county knew, and there was no evidence of actual knowledge at the time of the attack that wolf dog hybrids were more dangerous than other dogs.
Okay, so they were trying to hold basically a third party, an uninvolved
right.
third party,
yes,
liable
because they,
for this.
Yes, that's right. So it really doesn't apply to private shelters, this case, but it does speak to the special sort of, you know, the special promise rule in the sense that if a county does make a special promise, they too could be liable. In other words, if a county says, look, we're going to let you adopt this wolf hybrid, but you need to have a pen that's XYZ and you need to have this and that, they then have to go out and fulfill that promise in order to avoid liability. Which is why, you know, nobody ever makes these special promises, because that's an exception to the general rule that, look, you have general animal control duties, but that doesn't make you liable for every dog of a private shelter that's adopted out.
Now, just real quick, sorry, I don't mean to keep interrupting you, but you said the special promise thing. If they, like, let's say they don't fulfill their duty enclosure.
Okay, I'm going to do this. The next case I'm talking about, which is a case out of Tennessee from the Tennessee Supreme Court. And in that case, the court held that a municipal shelter could be liable for a special promise or special duty exception because they failed to follow up on and enforce its order to fix the fence and enroll pit bulls in obedience training program as a condition of their release following determination that they were dangerous. So what they're saying is, look, if you adopt a pit bull out from the city shelter and you say, look, we're going to let you have these dogs, but you have to have them with a certain fencing and they have to be – you have to follow up on that and make sure that happens. If you don't and the dog bites somebody, then the shelter can be held liable. So,
okay.
So that's the special, you know, exception rule.
I'm wondering if,
And I think if a regular shelter did that, I think they'd be likewise liable. And I'm about to discuss the case that frightens everybody. It's not reported because it was a settlement, and as far as I know, there was no reported case. There is, if you Google it, there is a case out of Fort Walton Beach, Florida, that happened in 1988, where a child, Nathan Carpenter, was killed by Chief, a wolf-husky mixed breed, in a family's backyard after it was adopted from the animal shelter. The animal shelter was Panhandle Area Welfare Society, or PAWS, and they agreed to pay $425,000 to the parents of this child that was killed in this wolf dog attack. Because the adoption was permitted despite the PAWS policy that said that they would not adopt out wolf breeds. So what we have is we have a situation where this adoption violated the very policies of the private shelter, and you have a specific problem. I mean, it makes sense to me that if you have a policy that says you're not going to do this and you do it and somebody's killed, that you've got a liability problem. So obviously the takeaway from this is don't do adoptions that are in contradiction to policies that you've instituted at your shelter. And this is to my knowledge is the highest of you know settlement and probably the only settlement that I've read about so far where a private shelter was required to pay this. Of course, their insurance company, I think, probably paid it. I can't imagine a small panhandle area welfare society having $425,000 sitting around. The facts are that, you know, they adopted, Chief was featured as the shelter's pet of the week in the local newspaper. Randall Lockwood, who's a very famous dog bite expert, said, "I've known thousands of wolf hybrids, and there are very few of them that have happy endings. We've taken wild animals out of the wilderness, and they're the first and foremost predators." He said the dog probably never recognized the victim as a human being. The boy's jugular vein was severed. This was a predatory attack. The important thing is realize that something as simple as crawling could trigger such an attack. The plaintiff's mother said she saw the dog running loose near her home, didn't recognize it, and didn't know her neighbors had just adopted the animal. So let me go back and say that this was not a case where the parents had adopted this animal. It was a case where their neighbors had adopted the animal and it got loose. So the mother then went inside to call the telephone number on the dog's tag. The dog went out in her yard and laid down, and then the next thing she knew, the dog was attacking her son. So the point is that this can happen, and the point is this is what you know the people who don't want to adopt out pit bulls are worried about. So my point would be, you know, if you have a pit bull non-adoption policy, you can't very well adopt out pit bulls and then expect not to have liability. So you'd have to change that policy, and then you'd have to follow all the things that I've just talked about, which is not retain possession of the animal in your adoption agreement. Make sure that you put in there that you're not warranting that the dog has any particular behavior or that he won't ever bite anybody or that he's got a good temperament. Make sure the dog is properly temperament tested, and make sure that the adoption follows the policies of your shelter. And if you follow those things, there is not a case where those things have been followed where the shelter has been held liable for a subsequent bite. And so, Chris,
now let's say that a shelter has a non-adoption policy for pit bulls,
yes.
And then they change that policy. Could they be held liable because they had at one time had a non-adoption policy?
Well, I can't say yes or no to that because that's never been discussed. But my thought is that this is not like a wolf hybrid. I mean, the only way that you can make that argument would be to talk about wolf hybrids as wild animals. And so my thought is that it's a false equivalency. Trying to say that a bull is like a wolf hybrid is not accurate, and the science would not support that comparison. So my answer would be if you change your pit bull adoption policy and you properly set forth in your policy that you know there's the science behind the fact that pit bulls are not more dangerous than other dogs, and I think you'd be all right. But, you know, there's no guarantees in the law. You just don't. The problem is that they're always going to be looking for a deep pocket. But, you know, I think that if you do all the things I've said and you have an adoption policy that allows pit bulls to be adopted out, and even if you change that, I don't think it's the same as now, if you were in a state like Ohio that previously had decided that pit bulls were vicious, that might change the result. In other words, if you were in Ohio in 1989 and they had a statewide pit bull thing, then in that case I think that there would be an argument if you adopted out a pit bull under those circumstances, the state law would give the plaintiff the right to say, hey, you know, the state has decided these dogs should be treated different than other dogs. But no state does that anymore.
Yeah. And so getting back to the idea of like a rescue, retaining a right to ownership,
yeah.
As you were saying with the contract saying that the dog has to come back to them or, you know, the dog is remains microchipped to them or what have you.
Right.
In a case like that where they don't want to release you know, total control, let's say, of the dog, would a special waiver of liability cover them in that case?
I don't think so. I don't think you can. I mean, because you can't. I'm not sure that you can waive liability for a third party incident. So I think that those kinds of, and I just don't think that would work. I don't think that you could say to the person, and what good would it do? Let's say that you are the owner of a dog, and I signed a contract with you that said, look, you won't sue us if the dog bites someone, a third party. That third party is not part of that contract.
Not necessarily saying like that. I guess what I have in mind is saying, you know, like that you accept all legal liability stemming from any incidents with the dog, like that the adopter retains all the liability.
But what I'm saying is that you can't control what a plaintiff who's been bitten, who they sue. So let's say you had that. It says they get all the liability. The third party person who's bitten sues that person and the adoption place. They're not privy to that contract. That contract would only insulate the rescue from a lawsuit from the person who owned the dog. It would not stop.
It wouldn't stop a third party's lawsuit. They could sue them, but like, would it protect them? You know, from being ruled against, I guess, is kind of...
It wouldn't stop a third party from doing anything. A third party could sue whoever they want to. I mean, if you want to go even further, you could say to a potential adopter, not only will you take all responsibility, but if someone else sues us, you will indemnify us for any money that we have to pay. The problem with that is that indemnification... If the rescue has no money and they can't indemnify you, it's not worth anything.
Could you just clarify for non-legalese what you mean by indemnify?
Well, what that means is, let's say I have a dog and I adopt it to you. And I say to you, I'm giving you this dog, and what you're going to do is sign a paper that says, if I get sued because this dog bit somebody, Chris Diaz will pay all of the damages that are awarded against me as part of this adoption agreement, which is great. I mean, as far as it goes, but when that happens and somebody sues for $425,000, you're not going to have $425,000 to pay me that I paid the third party. So that agreement is only as good as your financial security. And
okay.
So,
yep. I understand what you're saying. It's
so,
kind of the blood from a stone theory, sort of,
Even though you agree to pay the judgment that's against me, it won't be of any value because you're not going to be, unless you had insurance, in which case, you know, I don't know that your insurance company would allow you to make that deal because they're on the hook if that happens. But I've never seen an adoption agreement where that would occur. Because I think most people would say, wait a minute, what does this mean? I'm not signing this. I mean, the person who's adopting the dog doesn't want to take on more. Maybe they don't care. Maybe they don't have anything, so they don't care. But I've never seen an adoption agreement with an indemnification clause in it like that. So in any case, I think that we've talked about, mainly the things that are in the control of the rescue. To recap, it would be to not retain an interest in the dog. To the extent that you do, you're letting yourself be an owner under a statute that says any owner, harborer, or possessor of a dog. And if you retain that right, you're allowing the plaintiff to say, these people retain an ownership interest, and therefore they're an owner under that statute. To make sure that the adoption meets your adoption policies, that you've temperament tested the dog and that the adoption agreement says that you're not warranting any particular temperament, that and that you disclose any prior issues with the dog, and that the person, you know, has been given all that information and understands it and is taking the dog as a result. So any questions, Chris? And if anybody needs any of these cases, I have them all. I'm not sure anybody would want to read them, but the lessons to be learned from them have been put forth here, and I think that's all you really need to know. If you really want to know more, you can email me, and I'll send you the cases. You have any questions, Chris?
No, I don't think I do. I think you answered all of my questions. My biggest one was, you know, the release of liability, because I seem to remember vaguely when we had, when we had adopted Rosie, that there was a thing in the adoption contract saying, you know, that the shelter would not be liable for any damage caused by the dog in the future.
Well, the problem with that is they can't really say that if they haven't done all the things that I've talked about. So, I mean, it's just like, you know, when somebody says, well, let's say that you're an independent contractor in this contract. That doesn't mean that the court's going to find that person's an independent contractor just because you call them that. The court's going to look at the relationship between the employer and the independent contractor and say, okay, here's a test. It's these 10 tests. You know, do you control where the person works? Do you tell them what time? Do you give them stuff that they work with? Do you all those things? And they'll come back, and they've said many times, we're not bound by what how the parties define their relationship. And the same thing's here. If for example, if they were to say, if the dog had 5 previous bites and they didn't disclose them, and then they put in their agreement, we were not going to have any liability for subsequent bites, that would not prevent you from suing them if you found out later that they did know about those 5 bites and didn't disclose them to you.
Okay.
You see what I'm
saying? So it's sort of like putting up this, you know, if you're a business, putting up that sign saying we reserve the right to refuse service for any reason. It looks good, but effectively it means nothing.
No, what you have to do is make sure that you do what you're supposed to do on the regarding the actual facts of what it is you're doing. So if you're adopting a dog out who has had a previous incident, you need to disclose that, because if you don't and it bites someone else, then you're going to be looked at regardless of what you put in there. You're going to be – somebody's going to say, hey, you didn't disclose this to me.
We have some people in chat that would be interested in the cases that you're talking about.
I'm seeing Jim Tomaszewski, however you pronounce his name. I have his stuff, and I will send it to him. And there's also an issue of whether or not a waiver is effective in gross negligence. Gross negligence, in other words, if you completely do something intentional, even if you have a waiver that says I'm not going to sue you, that waiver isn't any good. The truth is, waivers are really not favored in the law, particularly if they are waivers of your own negligence. So if I adopt you out a dog and I say, look, I'm not going to be, you have to sign this paper that says I'm not going to be responsible if I'm negligent in adopting out this dog to you. Most courts would say, you know, that's not going to, it's against public policy to allow people to get dogs. I mean, if you're allowed to do that, then everybody just do whatever and put that clause in there. So it's against public policy. So in that case, you would not want to rely on a clause in a contract if you're doing something that isn't proper in the adoption process in itself. So I had a case where a guy signed a waiver on a jet ski in Key West. Actually, it was Tavernier, which is in the middle of the Keys in Florida, and basically said that, you know, that he understood this kid was underage. He got on this jet ski and he wasn't trained properly, and he had an accident and really injured another guy. And the court basically said, you know, we're not going to follow that waiver because number one, the guy's a minor who was riding it, but number two, public policy is such that we're not going to allow this jet ski place that is you know, taking money in exchange for renting out these jet skis to get away with preventing suits for its own negligence. So these are issues that are pretty complicated and may not make sense. But basically, courts will not enforce statutory things if they're against public policy. So let's take a break, and we'll come back with Yvette. And I'm sure, Chris, that you have a totally exciting topic for Yvette tonight.
You're listening to Pit Bulletin Legal News Radio. Follow us by clicking the follow link in the upper left-hand corner at www.blogtalkradio.com/pit-bulletin-legal-news. Or better yet, join our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/pitbulletinlegalnews to hear the latest news and updates during the week. Join the discussion during the show by logging into chat as a guest through Facebook or call us at 646-595-4137.
All right, we're back. Chris, I want to ask you if you're going to get an Apple Watch.
Oh.
For $10,000. If so.
Yeah, I'm not going to get anything for $10,000, and I'm out of the loop on this. I'm not quite sure what you're talking about.
Good, that's what I hoped. All right, so now we're going to go to Canada, where I'm sure it's a balmy 65, and talk to our Canadian resident cold person.
And as it goes on, and as it goes on.
Wow, that song makes me think of steamy hot tubs, hot summer nights, with the beat going on. And so what's the temperature up there, Yvette?
It's above freezing, believe it or not. It's awesome. The snow, it's like gone from, you know, minus 20 Celsius to like 6, 7, 8 degrees Celsius very quickly. So it's like, oh, finally. But yeah, so I mean, I guess.
But what do you guys consider hot tub weather up there?
Oh, shoot. I mean, I'm assuming people may, I don't know. I don't have a hot tub. I guess maybe it depends how they build it in.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like you come up here, we build in to kind of keep it cold out, and you guys, you know, if you're down in Florida, you guys have that netting up to keep bugs out of your yard or whatever.
Yeah,
it
was 85 down here today.
Oh, shush. Oh, well.
I got
cold
the fan
and warm
on.
Up. I was going to say, you're resident
the
cold person.
I'm turning
cold
on the
hand,
AC.
Warm heart, right?
I'm turning on the AC. In fact, I'm asking Denise, do you have your AC on over there?
I too have my AC on.
Oh my God! See, we can just
you guys
funnel
are
that.
Such wimps! Come on.
Hey man, it's 85. Come on.
Yeah, yeah, shouldn't we be used to that? Isn't it like always hot down there? This is
not when you have your AC on.
Oh man.
But I'm trying to understand how people tried cases, you know, in Miami in the summer with no AC. I just don't know how they could do it. You'd have to have, you know, take off your jacket and loosen your tie. It'd be like Clarence Darrow in the old days. But we're not here to talk about that, Yvette. We're here to talk about today's topic, which is, Chris?
Well, today's topic choice comes from Laura. She has recently added a new dog, and we were going to talk about how to effectively manage
That's for Laura's new dog.
Yes. She's so cute. She's the cutest little thing.
I saw it. She looks a little
Esme.
Long-legged.
She's very leggy. But so we're discussing managing a new dog's interactions with your existing dog.
Now, the first question is, Yvette, you would recommend not to be under the influence of alcohol or marijuana while doing this. That's
yeah,
your first
probably.
Advice.
Yeah, probably a good idea. Yeah, in general, well, yeah, when supervising dogs. So, yeah, absolutely. Glad you cleared that one up for me.
Well, I don't want to.
I might have forgotten that one.
I know it.
Slips my mind from time to time. No, but I mean, it is a valid.
There's smoke
coming
through my phone right now, and my microphone and my headphones from you. That's how hot you are up there. Yeah, you're smoking.
But, yeah, I guess, I mean, technically speaking, I guess if people have, like, you know, dogs and it's, you know, they're having to get together and they're, you know, in the warm weather and they're having a barbecue, they might have a few beers. Yeah.
Don't drop a hot dog.
Having a few, might not be a great idea to supervise and be intoxicated. Yeah, I'd say that's a wise idea. Absolutely. Yeah.
Just don't drink and dog.
Yeah.
okay. You guys can talk about this while I'm drinking.
Okay. Well, you're not managing, you know, any new dog interactions.
I'm not, but I've got two dogs asleep on the couch. That doesn't count.
No, that doesn't count. No. So, you know, you have an existing dog in the house.
Yep.
You're expanding your family, going through the, you know, kind of the dogs are starting to get to know each other a little bit and feeling each other out. You know, when you're dealing this and you're dealing with the two dogs in the sort of like getting to know you phase, I think, so first of all, what would be some things that you should be looking for that could be potentially problematic?
Wait a minute. Can music help this situation? Could playing music help the situation?
Yeah, but you know, some Barry White on. Yeah.
Well, no,
no,
I mean, it's not actually,
as
it might be a question sort of in jest, but there are people that feel that playing music can help with stress and stuff, although I would probably bet money on supervision over music any day. Yeah.
I can't believe that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and there's nothing, I mean, I think there's times and places where it can act as white noise and stuff. It can be beneficial, but not in this situation. I think you got to be on your toes when you're introducing a couple new dogs to each other. Yeah. So anyway, so I guess I should answer the question now, right?
No, I'm trying to
derail
you here.
Well, I know
Fred,
you are. And you're still
kind
of trying to, can I bring this back to dogs? All right, what to watch out for? I think there are common problems. The number one thing that I think really flares up sometimes when you're adding a new dog is resource guarding. So whether it's that the dog's protective of space or bones or toys or food, that's one that really commonly airs its ugly head. And I generally suggest that people take at least 30 days to kind of get to know dogs. That sometimes it can take a little while before you see true colors on a new dog. And also the impact the new
dog
has.
Kind of like
when
you're dating, you know, it takes probably a year to get to know somebody.
Yeah. So, I mean, they sort of change and adjust to one another, and you're there's less space available per body when you're adding a new dog. So that kind of stuff can, you know, impact them. So I tend to think of every new resource that I'm adding into the mix, I'm hyper aware of it and how they're reacting to it, making sure that each dog does have their own place where they can go lie down, that they don't feel the need to compete over resting areas, and that, you know, especially with the younger dog that might be pestering an older dog, that if the older dog's trying to, you know, get some, you know, sleep on a bed or couch or a mat, that they're not getting annoyed where each day starts to stomp on their nerves a little bit more. So I'm very hyper aware of resources, especially the ones that aren't obvious, such as personal space, sleeping areas, because there's nothing you're actually giving to the dog. The space is sort of surrounding them. So I'm always kind of watching that interaction on how are they managing the resources between them. And I also look at it from the point of view of every first interaction is a chance to make a positive first impression between them. So if, let's say I happen to notice, let's say my dog is eating and I notice the new dog is approaching, I'm on it to say, yeah, good job. Like even just to make that a positive experience that, wow, the new dog approached you while you're eating. Now, obviously I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't allow that to happen if I had serious concerns about that one dog might hurt another. So you don't do that without some forethought. You know, I don't just kind of allow the dogs to approach. But when you're at that phase where you're saying, you know, can we have the meeting in the same room? And there's probably going to be a lot of difference, too, whether you're introducing a, you know, young puppy or if you're introducing a dog that perhaps has a bad history where there might have been abuse or neglect or behavioral problems. So I'm hypersensitive about the resource guarding. That one is a really, really big one that I think people need to watch out for.
And it's very interesting because if you, like, in this case, you know, it's a second dog.
Yep.
There's one dog living in the space.
Yep.
So you don't really know
right.
unless, you know, like, I mean, unless you've had other, like, foster dogs or stuff like that. And even, you know, the interactions dog to dog might be different. But it really, like, if you only have the one dog and the one dog has only ever lived in that space by itself with no other dogs, you don't really know how they're going to react to another dog being around their bed.
Well, they're the only dog.
They're
the only dog. They're used to that.
Exactly.
That would be harder.
Right. And if you, like with Kip, he'd had so many other dogs, like foster dogs, come through. I was pretty confident of his reaction to other dogs, so I could take liberties that I might not have taken in other situations with other dogs, right? So knowing your dog and their history and how they react to dogs in their space is going to affect how you're going to change things. And I think that's where sometimes people say, yeah, I just let them go. And if dad just introduce them, let them work it out. Some people might be able to get away with that just because their dog is tolerant. But really, truly, when you're doing this and you don't have that, yeah, my dog's had 10 dogs in the last year come through here, that experience to draw on to say, I'm pretty confident how my dog will react, regardless of what type of dog comes through here, unless you have that to fall back on, you're acting with a bit of an unknown. So it's good to kind of just sit back, really carefully monitor, use safety protocols. So if you're unsure of things like the food, you could use a baby gate. You know, say feed the one dog on one side of the baby gate, and then the other dog is brought in from the other side, and you kind of say, let's see how this goes. So you put safety, you know, just gauge their reaction to one another and then make it a positive first experience so that you're not surprised with a fight that you weren't anticipating, because you don't want fights breaking out, especially at the beginning, setting the tone for the dynamics between those two dogs.
And you don't want to, you should be carrying a water bottle around with you?
I don't know, why are you dehydrated after all that booze?
Exactly.
I personally do not carry a water bottle around.
I do, but I drink a lot of water.
No, we just go out back, dig up the snow, melt it down, you know, that's what we do. I'm kidding, no we don't. I better be careful, people might think I'm serious about that.
I'm assuming you're meaning to correct the dog with
a spray of water.
Yeah.
No, I don't. And it's interesting because I've seen people actually walking down the street with their little squirt bottles sometimes. And the problem with things like that is it doesn't take a rocket scientist of a dog to realize that you can only spray them with water if you have the water bottle within reach. So to me, that's not something that I find incredibly practical. I find some dogs love water. Like, you do that to a proper lab, they're like, woohoo, spray me again. So you're reinforcing the behavior. So it's not something that I ever use. Plus, at some point, most owners do want to give their dog a bath. So I think in terms of long term, you want your dog to enjoy being sprayed with water. So if you ever do want to give them a bath, that you're not fighting them in the tub. So I think, yeah, not my go-to choice. Actually, I can't say I ever use it.
So pepper spray and mace then?
No, don't
use
that
either.
That's
like a terrible idea.
I was going to say, if you're bringing that
pepper
type
spray
of dog into your house where you're considering that, you probably made the wrong choice somewhere along the lines to these two dogs coming together.
Yeah.
I tend to have
pepper spray in general is just a terrible idea because nobody
ever sits
there. I do it to
my neighbors.
Nobody
to my neighbors when they're annoying.
And thinks like, well, you know, the wind's blowing back at me and maybe I should turn because I'm about to get a face full of pepper spray. So, yeah, pepper spray is not the best tool, period, for much of anything.
Yeah, I think the best tool to take along with you when you're working a couple dogs is your brain. Sorry.
Ooh, that's
my second most
favorite organ.
Oh, man. So, resource guarding, just ignoring
yeah,
that.
We'll just ignore them. We'll just keep talking amongst ourselves.
So, like, there can be little warning signs as far as resource guarding that, you know, like, things that aren't full-blown, like, big explosive issues.
Yep.
So as far as, like, let's say, quote-unquote, low-level resource guarding or maybe the beginning stages of a more serious resource guarding issue, what should you look for with that, you know, the dog's behaviors to determine whether or not this is really going to be something that has to be addressed?
Okay. So, for example, some dogs, when they're rather than fighting over a bone, you'll see one dog, they'll take a bone and they'll take it to a quiet spot, where they're not comfortable chewing in close proximity to another dog. So that sort of choice, like you're watching whether they're increasing distance or decreasing. Now, you don't want to get overly paranoid. If a dog's just taking a bone to their mat because the mat's comfortable and that's where they chew their bones, fine. But it's almost like this, no, I can't settle down here. I need to get away from this potential threat. I can't enjoy my bone otherwise. So watching those types of reactions, and that's towards dogs or towards people. A lot of times dogs that are resource guarders of bones and toys will take those items under couches, under beds, under coffee tables, into corners.
Or outside.
Yeah. So you're looking for that kind of thing. Another thing to watch out is sometimes it'll be this inability to eat when food's put down, and it's almost like they'll dart back and forth between bowls. So if one dog goes to one bowl, they'll dart to the other dog will dart to that same bowl and back and forth and back and forth. Not in that sort of obnoxious puppy way, but almost like I can't eat because I have to control both bowls and they're both mine, and I have to just keep you away from both. You might see some muzzle punching. That's when they take their nose and they're kind of boxing the other dog away. So those are things where I kind of say, okay, it's not the end of the world, but I personally don't like living that way. So I just kind of go, okay, let's work on this. Because it just seems to make sense to work on things when they're easy and there's not a lot of danger involved rather than letting it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Who would want to just wait until the fight breaks out, you know?
Oh, I think that's one of the worst sort of things that trainers complain about is you'll get calls from people and they'll say, yeah, this dog has done damage and, you know, something has happened. And you kind of start getting a history and you say, well, you know, has this happened before? Well, yeah, last week there was an incident. Now it's happened twice in a row, really concerned. And you say, well, how old's the dog? And they say, well, he's, you know, 8. And you say, well, when did you first notice any growling or snapping? Yeah, well, when he brought him home at 8
5 years ago.
Oh. It's like, so you let it sit for 8 weeks. And it's like, so what's motivating you change that now? Well, we're having a baby. We're doing 2 months. It's like, excuse me?
Oh, wow.
It's such a common thing, and it's like this pressure of you not only need to fix this dog that's had problems for 8 years, it's been festering, getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. Now the dog's doing damage, and the pressure of, and you're bringing an infant into this? Oh, my God. Oh, it's trainer's worst nightmare to have all of that come together because there was so much time to deal with this issue, and it didn't happen. So it just drives me bonkers, if there's one thing people would start doing, it's if you see a problem, get on it now, you know, and not sort of in that I went online and Googled it in the, you know, get some help, deal with it, get it done with, move on. It definitely prevents a lot of problems down the road.
So let's talk for a minute about, like, people as resources. Because, you know, you can obviously, a person can be a very valuable resource to a dog.
Yes.
Like, let's say that a dog, the new dog, excuse me, has bonded very strong, you know, a little bit more strongly to one half of, you know, the couple and not both people.
Okay.
You know, is sort of distant, let's say, from the other half. How would you go about maybe equalizing the bond between, you know, the dog and maybe sort of prevent as a preventative measure, I guess, from the one half of the couple becoming a resource?
Okay. I mean, for most dogs, they tend to have a preference one way or another, a slight amount of preference. So if it's just that kind of minor, yeah, you know, like mom does more stuff with me, it's not a big deal. If it becomes like you'll see some dogs that, you know, they bond very highly with one person. They're either afraid or they're guarding that person away from them. That's when you want to, well, there are two different problems. With the fear-based thing, we start switching it over and saying, okay, this fearful person, they're going to start working on creating positive associations. But you're not worried about resource guarding. You're dealing with fear. If you're dealing with the resource guarding, what you're looking at is teaching the dog to be accepting and, happy, for lack of a better word, when anybody enters their space. So I am a huge fan, and it's kind of interesting because isn't an interesting exercise because it crosses a lot of lines, and in terms of, you'll hear people say things in some training circles like, you know, you might feed one dog first, the submissive dog first, and you feed the dominant dog second in order to bring it down a notch. You hear something like that?
Yeah.
Okay. No, but it's actually, it's really interesting because there's another way of phrasing that, which is the same exercise, if I think about it. And I think, because usually the dominant dog is the one people, usually it's the one that's being aggressive. That's what how they phrase it. Now, the other way of looking at it is saying the resource guarding is the aggressive dog. So I'm going to feed a cookie first to the calm, non-reactive dog, and the reactive dog gets a cookie second. So it's still the same thing, that the reactive dog gets the cookie last. But I can also look at that where the dog realizes, hey, if you come into my space and you get a cookie, yippee, I get one next. So the dog starts looking forward to that association. So I think sometimes how we interpret why something works, you know, the fact that that association will be created, it's still going to be created. It just, you don't have to phrase it in that sort of dominant submissive type way. It is an association. But you want to make sure that you're not asking the dog without issues to come in too close before the reactive dog or the resource guarder is prepared to handle him coming that close. So I do tend to a lot of, I call it space invasions. Anytime there's an invasion of space on that dog, so somebody's come in and shaken mom or dad's hand, great, you get a cookie. You know, there's been an invasion of space that could have been perceived as a threat. You know, somebody is approaching your food dish, woohoo, you get a cookie. So yay, please approach my food dish. So those types of space invasions, I'm really big on just kind of making sure that I tip that association into a positive framework as much as possible.
But I've heard just the opposite. I've heard that to get dogs to get along, that you should continue supporting the dog that's, you know, the higher up on the totem pole.
Yeah, some people do say that too.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean,
I take care of that.
Well, I mean, you look at, well, but if you look at it from an association
people
point
say
of
lots
view,
of things.
People say to go around and pee around your property line, and that way the dog won't leave the property. It doesn't mean that I'm going to do that. Maybe I've also heard only man pee works on that one. But in terms of an association, I think what some people are suggesting is that the resource guarder is given more of a wide berth, and that the dog that's not guarding ends up sort of being encouraged to stay away and not instigate a fight. My life's kind of a little bit too busy to live on eggshells like that. Now, I would crate and rotate if I had to. I've done it in the past. But I did it when Kiki was 14, and we brought Kip in for fostering as a puppy. And I mean, part of it has to do with an age thing, some of the decisions where you say, is this worth it to me to have these two get along when I know one dog is right near the end of their life and the other dog is just starting? Or am I just putting more stress on the elderly dog? And we made the decision that it was just more stressful for the elderly dog.
All right, well, we're going to have to end on that note because guess what? We're out of time. As usual, you've been a font of information, Yvette.
Well, thank you.
And we appreciate your coming on the show. I want to thank Laura, Denise, and, of course, Chris Brown Sugar for being on tonight's show. I hope it wasn't too boring. A lot of legal stuff, but important stuff nonetheless. Tune in next week, same time, same station, for another edition of Pitbull and Legal News Radio. Good night, everybody.
Good night.